Beloved community. When we hear this term, we often think about folks we know well and love and are in community with already. We think about folks in our neighborhood, in our family, or in our congregation. We like to think of WOOF as a special and wonderful beloved community, and it really is. Many people find Unitarian Universalist congregations like ours to be communities of like-minded folks where we feel beloved and care for each other and love each other. And it's nice to feel beloved in our churches. But I actually want to hold up a different turn of the phrase of beloved community, a different definition. Beloved community is the context. In this context, is made popular by the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King back in the 60s, but it actually came from a philosopher theologian, Josiah Royce, who initially coined the terms years earlier. Royce was the founder of a movement called the Fellowship of Reconciliation, which King was a member of. Dr. King did not want beloved community to be confused with some kind of a utopian idea where the lion literally lays down with the lamb and there's no sadness in the world. He knew better than that. But he was talking about something that he thought was realistic and achievable, albeit difficult. He was talking about something that could happen if we achieved critical mass of people who were trained in nonviolence and were committed to a better world for all people. Dr. King imagined a world where all the people on the earth could be readily sharing in the wealth and in the care. He imagined a beloved community where the whole world was not troubled by hunger and homelessness because they were not tolerated by society. They were seen as outside the standards of human decency. King looked for a world without so much racism and discrimination and bigotry. They would be replaced by ideas of the family of humanity. Communication would replace war in sorting out differences, and love and trust would be stronger than fear and hate. Dr. King did not imagine a world with no conflict at all. He knew that conflict was a part of the human condition, but he did believe the conflict could be handled in a nonviolent manner. And King said, "The aftermath of nonviolence is the creation of beloved community, so that when the battle is over, a new relationship comes into being between the oppressor and the oppressed." He also said, "I do not think of political power as the end, nor do I think of economic power as the end. They are ingredients in the objective we seek in life, and I think the end and the objective truly is a brotherly society, the creation of beloved community." So as you can see, this beloved community that he is talking about is much bigger than just our wonderful beloved community here at WOOF. It's about the community in the wider world, as our mission calls us to serve. It's not that these smaller beloved communities don't matter. They do. But the goal is to make the whole world a place where we can be respectful in communication and where that kind of thing can replace violence and everybody can get their needs met. So, and many people believe, I actually am one of those, that the purpose of congregations like ours, where we have these small beloved communities, is of course to practice and train so we can then make the whole world a beloved community. That's the idea. So I heard this speech at GA a couple of years ago by a very respected and experienced minister named Fred Muir. And he's then since published this material in an updated form in a book. The piece is called From iChurch to Beloved Community. And this is what he says keeps Unitarian Universalism from being the force for good we can and should be in the world. So it keeps us from being leaders in the creation of King's version of the beloved community. In explaining this to us, first, Reverend Muir holds up an example that's a bit troubling. It's an example of the British Unitarians. The Unitarians in Britain have been well established. In fact, there was Unitarianism in Britain long before it came to America. The British Unitarians have quite a bit in common with their relatives here across the pond. Here's a statement of how they describe themselves on their web page. Unitarianism is an open-minded and welcoming approach to faith that encourages individual freedom, equality for all, and rational thought. There's no list of things Unitarians must believe. Instead, we think everyone has the right to reach their own conclusions. We see different opinions and lifestyles as valuable and enriching, and we don't discriminate on grounds of gender, age, race, religion, or sexual orientation. Although Unitarianism has roots in Jewish and Christian traditions, it is open to insights of all faiths, science, the arts, the natural world, and everyday living. Sounds a lot like us, doesn't it? Yeah, it works. Yeah. Well, Reverend Fred Muir points out that the British Unitarians are in trouble. Big trouble. He says the Unitarianism in Brits has about 3 generations left before it's going to be gone and extinct. Here are the numbers he cites. 1/2 of their churches have closed in the past 80 years. Their big congregations. Their big congregations are about the size of Woof. Like the biggest one is 150 members. And the average member of a congregation is under 20. This despite the fact that the Unitarian churches in Britain have some really lovely buildings all over the country. So the culprit in the decline of Unitarians in Britain is not love or money, but an issue that actually they have in common with us, according to Muir. It is the UU culture that is problematic in England and is also prevalent here that keeps new people from finding us as interesting as they might and keeps us from doing the things we need to do. Muir worries that unless we can make some changes, we will end up in the same downward spiral as the British Unitarians. Because he says we are suffering from ministers to members, from a trinity of errors that lead to our ineffectiveness and make it inevitable and effect and make it it's hard for us to share our liberating message when we have this trinity of errors. He says they erode our vitality and our relevance. And in describing these errors, I will quote directly from Muir using his words. First, we are being held back and stymied, really being held captive by a pervasive, persistent, disturbing, and disruptive commitment to individualism that misguides our ability to engage with the changing times. I'm hearing some amens out there. Second, we cling to Unitarian Universalist exceptionalism that's often insulting to others and undermines our good news. And third, we refuse to acknowledge and treat our allergy to authority and power, though all its symptoms compromise the health of our future. Well, I'm glad I didn't surprise anybody. Yes, individualism, exceptionalism, and issues around authority. That's us, all right. And not just us, of course, but congregations all over this country. It's not so much it's everywhere, and that this does get in the way of us thriving as a faith. It gets in the way of us truly helping to create that kind of beloved community that King talked about for sure. In fact, I think it actively undermines our work. It's actively getting in our way. We come by these traits really honestly. It's not a surprise we have them in some ways. There's some history behind it. We come from a very long line, and I mean a very long line of heretics, going back to the days when heretics were burned at the stake, including us. Early Unitarians in the 1500s and 1600s were persecuted for their heretical and radical beliefs that Jesus was a spiritually gifted human being and not part of God. When you're under that kind of pressure, you do band together against others as a necessary form of survival. But really, much later, when our faith is no longer dangerous to espouse, the traits that foster that are still there. That's still banding together business. And then our wonderful, most famous Unitarian minister, Ralph Waldo Emerson, he really fanned the flames of that Unitarian identity as being that church for the independent oddball. He said, and I'm quoting here, "No law can be sacred to me but that of my nature. Those who would be a man must be a nonconformist. Nothing at last is sacred but integrity of your own mind." Nothing wrong with that, but many of those early Unitarian Transcendentalist thinkers, they were the hippies of the 19th century. And they're really into do your own thing, you know? They were also fighting against the American establishment at that time. But to look at it in the context, you've got to remember that those Transcendentalist free thinkers were very much people of power and privilege in Boston at the time. They had a certain ability to take that position that didn't ever put them in any jeopardy. They were like the countercultural upper crust of New England. And then you get to the 1950s with the Fellowship Movement, which called on folks to form small, independent, liberal religious groups in university and scientific communities. And you can just see where the historical progression has taken us. But this is what I see the situation is as with Unitarian Universalism today. We are great folks with a great faith. I am very committed to our faith. And many of us are attracted to Unitarian Universalist congregations because we felt like we found our people. I know that happened to me. Wonderful groups of people, like-minded folks who band together to take shelter from the mainstream society dominated by those orthodox religions. We gather to be with people who listen to NPR and shop at Trader Joe's. Well, it's great to find a place where we feel at home. It really is. But there's a dark side to this sense of finding ourselves as unique people. We may believe everybody has inherent worth and dignity, but sometimes we might get tricked into thinking we're a little bit more dignified and worthy than, say, Muslims or Baptists. This is the part that I think of as exceptionalism. I have heard many a good UU say things like, "I enjoy the Unitarian Church because this is where all the well-educated people are." Really? My brother, the Lutheran inorganic chemistry professor, my daughter's Catholic medical school professors, and our Congregationalist president, they're not well-educated? I don't know. Sounds to me like we're saying that we're better than other people, and I don't think we are. And think about how that reflects on how we sound to other people when we're trying to do interfaith work. In terms of individualism, it's great that we all feel valued for who we are and that we don't feel like anybody has to fit into a mold that other people have made them. That's great. It's a wonderful thing that that's how we raise our kids, to love themselves for who they are. I think that it's wonderful how we make decisions with the democratic process. Our members have one vote each, no matter how much they donate, no matter how long they've been around. Individuality is a great thing in our congregations, but it's not the same as rampant individualism. What happens when our respect for the very highly valued individual gets in the way of creating our ability to serve the common good and our common aspirations? This can be a problem. This is especially true if there's any diversity of opinion in the group, which ideally there is, if we're not all exactly the same. I believe this is why consensus decision-making works really well for Quakers, but not so well for UUs. See, the Quakers have generations and generations of being committed to the success of the entire congregation being way more important than the needs and desires of any one individual. And UUs are not so practiced at that. Making sure every individual is never disenfranchised in decision sometimes keeps Unitarian Universalist groups from being able to serve any common aspiration and any common good. At that point, the beloved individual really gets in the way of creating beloved community. And then there's our allergy to authority. Muir says, our resistance to authority often results in the misuse and abuse of our power. If folks who distrust authority are asked to lead, their position can sometimes be used to prevent a group from moving forward in any cohesive direction rather than to facilitate it. If a lot of time and energy is spent protecting each other from the leaders within a church, then the congregation is just filled with a spirit of conflict and mistrust. It's really not a good way to practice being in beloved community. Muir says the misuse of power and authority is a factor in our inability and unwillingness to welcome and listen to diversity of interests and passions, that we become distracted and immobilized. In reflecting on how our trinity of errors keeps us from bringing about King's vision of the beloved community, I got thinking about a phrase a lot of our young people are using these days called microaggressions. It's a term used a lot in the anti-racism, anti-sexism worldview about behaviors that are not intended to be hurtful in any way, but come out of our subtle manifestations of our underlying prejudices. We may not be aware that we're doing them, but they're hurtful nonetheless, and they can wear people down. Studies of microaggressions show that people, say, in the Black community who are presented with these constant subtle bits of sexism, that it wears people out, brings about depression, hopelessness, anger. Examples of microaggressions might be the one Black student in a school who is constantly expected to be the typical Black person in class discussions rather than being a person themselves. Other common examples might be the sexualized compliments to the attractive young waitress, or the assumption that someone you meet whose last name is Gonzalez automatically is fluent in Spanish and has come to this country recently. A microaggression, no. It's not the same as having the KKK burn a cross on your yard. But microaggressions are hurtful, and they're exhausting. Here's my theory. I believe that this trinity of errors we have, the individualism and exceptionalism and allergy to authority, I think they perpetuate a stream of microaggressions that keep us from doing the work we need to do, building that beloved community that King talked about. I believe sometimes they even keep us from welcoming new people and being open-hearted. That may be some of what's going on in England. Let's say that someone has never been particularly good at school, and they come to a UU church because they've heard that they're a friendly place and they want to check it out. And someone who begins talking to them says, well, what I really like about the Unitarians is the intellectual nature of our services. You know, everyone here is such an intellectual. That's going to feel like a microaggression. Absolutely. You may feel like you don't really belong there when really you do. And I'll tell you straight up, there is nothing about you were born right the first time and nobody needs to be afraid to go to hell and everybody's okay and we're all in this together. You don't need a PhD to do that. That's something everybody can do. Or let's say somebody who has come out of, say, those people who do the justice work in the trenches with the poor all over the world, groups like the Jesuit Volunteer Corps or the Catholic Worker Movement. Let's say one of them comes to a Unitarian Universalist church and hears, we are so social justice oriented, our congregation. We had a really wonderful speaker on social justice just the other day, and we're donating to this really special cause. That's going to feel like a microaggression and a disrespect to those people they've been working with in another faith who've had boots on the ground. Especially if we talk about how we do social justice better than they do. I also think about our issues around individualism and authority. When one of our leaders, either a religious professional or an elected lay leader, is trying their best to help a group build cohesion around a common goal and help focus the church's resources on meeting that goal, and they hear, well, I didn't agree to that, or some other similar comment, that's a microaggression. It wears out our elected leaders. It makes good people shy away from wanting to take leadership positions and do the work they could do. This is one of the reasons I am so proud and happy that Wolf put a section in the Covenant of Right Relations about how we will all abide by the vote of the majority regardless of what our own vote had been. What a great thing we did. It really helps us avoid getting stuck and really helps us get along better. Our congregations, where we love each other, feel connected in that special way, they are wonderful places. They can be places where, again, we practice those skills of communication and nonviolence that King talked about. They're a place of learning and a place of healing and a place of support. We can take that momentum and that strength that we gain in these small beloved communities and use them to build that larger version of beloved community that King talked about. We can do that as an act of our faith, a way to live our Unitarian Universalist values. But I think we can only do that if we're willing to give up our bad habits of individualism, exceptionalism, and fear of authority. They just fuel our microaggressions rather than enhancing our skills of nonviolence. They just hold us back and keep us isolated and separate from the greater family of humanity. Megan Esler sent me a wonderful quote this week. It speaks to the best of our Unitarian Universalist passion and service to the wider world, not just about being right in the kind of speakers we have on Sunday or the right causes we get petitions for. It has nothing to do with how unique and special we are. It has to do with something more. The quote is by Cherie Renee Thomas. Social justice work is love. A love that has the best hopes and wishes for humanity at heart. May it be so.